Blog Talk Radio.
Silo Wealth Advisory is the Mindful Money Company. Our investments screen over 5,000 companies across the globe for their environmental impact. We think it's important to consider how your investments can benefit you and society without sacrificing returns. Visit us at silowealthadvisory.com and check out our free 60-second retirement solution. For all your investment questions, call Jeff Bogart at 855-757-7452 or email Jeff at jeff@silowealthadvisory.com. Now, here's Jeff with the Mindful Revolution.
Namaste, everybody. I'm Jeff Bogart of Silo Wealth Advisory, the Mindful Money Company, and I'd like to welcome you to the Mindful Revolution, where we interview some of the world's foremost thinkers in mindfulness. We'd love to hear from you during the show, so give us a call. The number is 646-478-4157. Again, 646-478-4157. You can email me, jeff@silawealthadvisory.com. That's Sila, S-I-L-A, wealthadvisory.com. If you're my Facebook buddy, you can ask a question there as well. Real quick, before we get into the show, just want to remind everybody that all our shows are archived on Blog Talk Radio. So if you miss one, don't worry. Just go to Blog Talk Radio, search the show or search the name of the person we interviewed, and it's there for you. You can download these podcasts anytime at your convenience. Well, our guest today is Yogi Roth, and he's been described as a modern-day Indiana Jones. He's a media personality, college football analyst, best-selling author, motivational speaker, actor, and Emmy-nominated filmmaker. At heart, though, he's a small guy from a small town in Pennsylvania. Not a small guy, a guy from a small town in Pennsylvania who loves to share a good story. Win Forever, the New York Times bestseller he co-authored with Seattle Seahawks coach Pete Carroll, is one of those good, really great stories. His most recent story, though, is Life in a Walk, a documentary about a walk Yogi Roth took with his dad. And it's not just a walk to the park. It's actually a walk through Portugal and Spain along the Camino del Santiago. Yogi says his film is about making a decision to act and a strong feeling to spend time, more time, with his father. Today he'll discuss the making of that film, his ongoing exploration of human potential. He is also the co-founder of Win Forever, a brand inspired by Pete Carroll, the football coach, that furthers human potential, elevates mentorship, inspires leaders throughout the philosophy of competition. When he's not doing all the above, Yogi travels the nation delivering motivational presentations about living a life without limits. Namaste, Yogi.
Namaste. Thanks for having me.
Good. How are you today?
I'm doing great, man. I'm really excited to be on your show and, you know, have these conversations. And, you know, you've built up such a cool audience that is really down with mindfulness, right? And being present,
right,
and taking risks and going for it in life. So to me, I'm fired up, man. Thanks for having me on.
That's what it's all about. Great. I know today's a big day for you. You have a film opening that we'll get into later. So, but let's kind of tackle the elephant in the room. Is Yogi your given name, your Christian name, or is it the name, do you practice yoga? How did this all come about, the name Yogi?
Yeah, the elephant in the room. It's my real name, 100%. When parents were having kids, they decided to give each child an Indian name and an Israeli name. And then when we were born, they would decide based on instinct and what we looked like or whatever they felt, which would be our first name, which would be our middle name. And so they named me Yogi. My middle name is Zohar, and it's Hebrew. Our mom, she grew up in Israel, ended up immigrating over to the States. Our family is really big in really teaching us a variety of religions, a lot of variety of philosophies. Both of our parents are practicing within mindfulness, whether it's social work or psychology. So I grew up in a household that, you know, you probably would have called me Yogi anyway. So to me, it was important. And you kind of referenced the film. you know, I went on this walk with my dad, and I asked him all those questions, like, why did you name me Yogi? You know, all the things that we don't really ask our parents all the time, but, and it fits, you know, and there's a big psychology around the name that you're given, you know, and my dad told me all about that, and you're aware of that, man. So I think that I fit that name. I think as a kid, I fought yoga my whole life. Our parents tried to put it on us, and I just was going to be the athlete. And now, of course, my athletic career is over, and I practice multiple times a week and try to meditate as often as possible. So it works. It definitely got embedded in there at some point.
Great. Well, were both your parents Jewish, or was one Indian?
No, neither are Indian. Our mom is Jewish. Mm-hmm. Our father was raised Protestant. But, you know, as kids, we were really taken around to a variety of different synagogues, churches, mosques. I mean, just having the ability to understand and respect all religion, you know, at the end of the day, it's just having a belief and, you know, hopefully respect and kindness and, you know, helping other people maximize their potential and obviously doing that yourself. And I think our parents were really aware of that. And, you know, I've seen that as an explorer for the last decade or so, traveling around the world. And you find that there's a variety of different religions, but I think at the core of them, it's pretty similar, you know, in terms of just
the fundamental principles. Right. Right. So while we're on your childhood, tell us about growing up. You grew up in a small town, northeastern Pennsylvania, by Scranton. What was your childhood like? Were you active? Were you athletic? You know, where'd you go to college? Were you playing high school football, college football, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, well, I grew up in a tiny town in Pennsylvania. And if any of the listeners ever watched the movie Varsity Blues about a high school football team in West Texas, it was pretty much that. You know, nothing else existed to a large degree outside of our community. You know, I didn't have a stoplight in our town. You know, it was the barbershop, it was the post office, the bank, and the country store, and the pharmacy, and the basketball courts. And I grew up literally on the basketball courts and on the playground, just playing everything. You know, I wrote a book, after I wrote Pete's book, Win Forever, I wrote my own book called From PA to LA. And I really go back into what shapes us as individuals and specifically what shaped me. And it was the time, you know, on the playground, playing hoops, catching a football in this little town, and it's really where my competitive spirit and my competitive soul really started to get, you know, to develop, and I started to understand what competition truly meant. So it was an environment that was an extremely safe environment, but one that allowed me to explore a ton. You know, and I wasn't the greatest athlete as a young child. You know, you see some kids, you know, I surf a lot, and I'll see these little kids that are 4 or 5 years old just crushing it, and I wasn't that guy. I made my turn probably around 6 years old, and I can remember it vividly, just making a conscious decision saying, you know, I wasn't going to suck anymore. I wasn't going to not be a good athlete anymore.
Right.
And I just started working, and I just committed myself to my craft at the level that's necessary to find success. And away I went. You know, I played everything growing up and got lucky in high school, had some success, and I knew instantly after my freshman year I played on varsity in our little town. That was a cool thing, and I knew I could go play in college. And growing up in a little town, a lot of times, you know, you're not kicking Division I athletes out every year, so it's not very common. So for me, what I ran into a lot was the safe decisions and mentors, you know, trying to guide me from getting hurt and saying, you know, maybe you should go to a smaller school. You know, I had good grades. I could have gone to, you know, really good academic schools. And to me, I always had the thought of Thursday night football. I don't know if you watch Thursday night football, but in college football, that's a big night. It's kind of like Monday night in the NFL. And it's all, you know, it's the ESPN stage. It's millions of viewers.
Right.
I couldn't stomach the idea of sitting on a smaller campus and watching major college football happen on a Thursday night and me not playing it. And I always wanted to go to Notre Dame. And the day they turned me down, I literally said, all right, who plays them? And it was the University of Pittsburgh. And I had developed a relationship with Pitt, and I knew the staff. And that day, I said, I'm going to go to Pitt. And that's kind of pathetic. You know, I didn't do the research and drop into their communication school or sit in on a class. I just wanted to, you know, prove that I could play. And then I'm walking on their campus and played in my second game as a freshman and kind of got a little portion of my career.
Where does Pitt fit in as far as college football? Medium size, large? It's not Ohio State, obviously, or Penn State, right?
No, I mean, it is. And we beat Penn State. It's major college football. It's as big as you think you're going to get. You know, they're in the ACC now. I mean, they're playing from everybody from Notre Dame to, you know, to Penn State. So, yeah, no, it's major college football. And for me, it was a program that was kind of on the rise to drop in and you know, play in a place that had won multiple national championships and produced Heisman Trophy winners. I thought I could play there. And I knew their coach at the time. I thought he and I had a great vibe. His name was J.D. Brookar. We had a great relationship. And I said, I think he's going to give me a chance. And I knew in my heart I just needed one shot. And when you walk on, you have to understand that, you know, when you walk into a locker room, you know, as a Division I athlete, everybody's a star. You know, I was Pennsylvania's player of the year. Well, everybody was their state's player of the year. And when you get a major college football, nobody cares anymore. And that's an adjustment. And when you walk on, it's even worse. So a walk-on is someone who's not afforded a scholarship initially. So your locker room's way in the corner. You don't have maybe the suite equipment. You're not loved up as much as a scholarship, highly touted player. And all of that served as fuel for me. And I got lucky after my second year to be placed on scholarship, to start in a few games and have a solid career as a major college player. And you know, I always say now, and I heard this a year ago from a student athlete in college saying, you know, I'd rather be given a scholarship when I'm in college than given a college scholarship when I'm in high school, because that means I truly earned the college scholarship.
Right. Let me ask you this. Let's go back. You're Jewish, kind of, right? By birth. Your mom's Jewish, culturally Jewish. What was it like? I'm guessing there weren't many Jews in the small town, though.
No. Award. I mean, Scranton is a pretty Irish.
You tend to congregate to larger towns, right?
Yeah, and that was fine. You know, for us, it was really important for me to hang on to my heritage. Parents were both Holocaust survivors, and I did a TED talk about their Holocaust story. And for me to be a young kid, you know, 10, 12, 15, 18-year-old kid sitting around the dinner table, you know, at a holiday and hearing their stories of resiliency, of their competitiveness, what grit truly means, what hard work truly means, what survival truly is. To me, it really, it changed me. You know, it changed me as a young man. You know, I've never thought that pressure was playing in front of 100,000 fans or doing a TV show in front of millions. That's not a big deal to me, because I always go back and I think about what I was told from their stories of surviving the Holocaust or some experience that I've had overseas now as an explorer. So to me, as a kid growing up, there wasn't a large Jewish community, but it didn't matter. You know, and of course, you know, you hear when you're an athlete, you're often ridiculed when you go to other places. And I had heard whether it was anti-Semitic remarks or whatever it was. And to me, you have to understand, you joked about it, but, you know, being the small guy from a small town, I've always had the chip on my shoulder. And I think those things drove me. And whether it was hearing something in a game, because when you are the star player or a good player, people are always trying to get under your skin. I loved it, and I embraced it. And I think from a religious standpoint, it was a really unique opportunity for me to see all sides of Judaism, you know, from Orthodox Jews to going to New York City, you know, on bus trips with my dad and my mom, to, you know, very conservative Jewish communities. So I've kind of been all across the gamut. My heritage is really important to me. I believe in spirituality. I consider myself a spiritual man. You know, I don't go to temple every week. I'm not practicing every element of Judaism, but I'm as committed to my heritage.
No matzah next week for you then, right? Me
no, I'll do the matzah. I'll do the matzah and I'll fast. I kind of enjoy that.
Did you see by any chance a couple weeks ago they had a program, PBS was doing immigrants, and, you know, they had Italians in America coming to America. They had Jews coming to America. I wonder if you get to see that at all.
No, but I'm going to write it down right now. I need to check it out.
What's fascinating about it was a lot of it centered on the Jews who were Sephardic Jews. For people who don't know what Sephardic means, Jews who look kind of swarthy, they look, you know, like exotic looking, not Ashkenazi, not European looking Jews. And many of them lived in Egypt and Syria, and they were part of society. They're really ingrained until the State of Israel was created. They were then kicked out of those societies abruptly. You're talking about people who were civil engineers, generals, and they didn't want to leave. It was fascinating how they were never thought they would happen to be leave what they thought was their home.
Wow.
Just like we're Americans,
yeah,
they were Egyptians or Syrians. Yeah, it's fascinating. Interesting, most of them went to Iran. A lot of them went there, or they went to Iran. Then that changed, but all right. So we have a call. Would you like to take the call?
I'd love to take the call.
Okay, so we're going to talk to Fadia. Fadia is a frequent caller. She's been a guest host, and she teaches yoga to football players, among other things. Hello, Fadia.
Hello, Jeff. Hi, Yogi. How are you?
Doing great. How are you?
Great. I dig your name. I think it's cool. I was really wondering. I was like, is that his real name? Like, and then you just covered it, so we don't have to go over that again. But I find, you know, you guys are talking about the Jewish, you know, experience in humanity. And I've learned a lot of that. I studied political science at Eastern, and it's really a very unique, I want to say, situation, because it's like that when it was explained to me by my Jewish political science instructor that some Jews are Arab Jews, and you're like, wow, well, what's the conflict? You know, and really to me, there is no conflict. It's just more of a political, I guess, corruption going on. But anyways, it bums me out. It really does. I look forward to the day where we can just all be people. But anyways, Yogi, my question for you is, do you think that fitness has a spiritual side?
Great question.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, great question. And thanks for calling. I couldn't agree more. It has to. You know, if you want to really tap into it. Now, if you want a six-pack, if you want to look good, do you have to tap into your spiritual side of fitness? No, I don't think so. I mean, you can just do the workouts and away you go. But I think if you want to get to that place, you know, where, you know, psychologists would call it no mind, right? Or an athlete might call it in the zone. But get to a place where you get to experience some really unique elements in performance, you have to be able to tap into your spiritual side. I think you have to be open to it. I think your soul has to be open to it. You have to be able to feel everything from the fans and a live experience to your own breath when you're in a yoga class. And I think that's critical. You know, I work with a guy named Dr. Michael Gervais. You should check him out. He's probably the leading high-performance psychologist in the world. And what we always talk about when we walk into a team setting is we teach student-athletes or professional athletes how to breathe. And it may sound silly, but a lot of times we're never trained how to truly breathe and how to listen to our breath. And when I'm around quarterbacks specifically, you know, I do a TV show on quarterbacks, and they're always in their own head. And there has to be an element of tapping into the spiritual side, the soul of the position, of what it takes to truly be great. So, yeah, I think so wholeheartedly. I think a lot of times athletes, when they're young, we think we just go perform. And we slip into this zone every once in a while. And we can't believe it, right? We can't miss a jump shot. The baseball looks as big as a beach ball. The basketball hoop looks as big as a pool. And we're just not going to miss.
Is that when the game slows down, Yogi?
It's when the game slows down. But what the truth is that you're actually finally performing the game in real time. You know, when you really look at the science behind it, you know, and you really become mindful of the breath, the pitch, the rotation of the ball, the laces of the football when you're catching it or when you're throwing it. And when you can do that, then wow, then I think you're tapping into something unique. And that is when, you know, greatness happens. And when you look at players like Tom Brady, Russell Wilson, Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, they train themselves, because this is a trainable skill, to tap into it time and time and time again.
Oh, and I totally wholeheartedly agree with you. And you know, the thing about greatness is that I think in order to be truly a great individual, and that includes being a great athlete, you have to want to make other people around you feel great and be great. And, you know, I would say that as far as being an athlete and being the champion, the whole team has to realize that they're great together. To me, that's something I try to pass on to the players I work with, is that they need to really own it. Every cell of their body really needs to own their greatness. So, anyway.
Why don't you tell Yogi what you do with football players, Fadi? Why don't you tell them the kind of training you do for the college football team?
Well, breathing is huge, just because, like, the team will go, and most athletes will be, like, rapid breathing, you know, doing their thing, and they don't take the time to breathe slow and slow it down. And, you know, check in with themselves and do positive things and say positive things in their heads. And so that's what I do with them, is I'll take them through the yoga sequences, which are amazing. And I think the reason why athletes love them is because they're both spiritual. And so they kind of go hand in hand. If you're really truly, like you're talking about, yoga, a spiritual person, fitness is going to become a spiritual experience. And so I take them through the movement. And then at the end, we lay down, We do a visualization. I ask them to see themselves as great. I ask them to see themselves as the champions. So that's what I do with them.
So visualize. Wow, I love it.
Well, it's critical. I mentioned earlier my parents are both therapists, and when I was a kid, they would talk about visualization, and I didn't know what it meant. But as a performer, as an athlete, I'd lay in my bed and literally go through every play of the game, and I'd visualize it, and I'd get to the third quarter of a football game, and I would never play after that. And the reason why is because in my visualization, I already scored like 7 touchdowns, and the game was completely over. So, yeah, I couldn't agree more with the idea of visualization. It's so critical. And I think to your previous point about, athletes picking one another up, to me, I look at it as levels of competitors, right? When you kind of start, you're just trying to survive, right? You're trying to survive your workout with academics, your team setting, et cetera. But the great ones, the truly great ones, are the ones that don't necessarily worry about their competition, but they're the ones that say, hey, this is how I did it. And I know we're competing for the same job, but because I'm so comfortable in my ability, I want to give you the little secret that I had. And you're not giving away your edge. You're just making the team better. And when you look at the root word of competition, to me, it's a great exercise. Because if you Google it right now on your phone or your laptop, wherever you are, and you look at it, it says to strive against. And then when you look at the Latin root, it says to strive together. And to me, somewhere over the last X amount of years, we've totally shifted, specifically in the United States, in terms of what competition is. It's not beating the next guy. It's us competing against one another to have something really amazing. And, yeah, there's a winner and a loser, but this isn't about me winning over you or you asking a better question than the next person. It's about creating a really unique experience. And that's something hard to grasp. Clearly, coaches all don't get that. Clearly, athletes all don't get that. But I think the great ones really do.
Examples of that. Oh. I want to throw this in, Fadia. I don't know if you know who Bobby Knight was. Not my favorite person, but a great college basketball coach. He had a saying that the only person you're competing against is yourself.
Well, I would agree with that. But I think also that you have to realize collectively as a team, you have to come together because there is another team that you're competing against. So there's like both things happening simultaneously. I guess for me, it's just important that the team helps each other out. Like my daughter is playing soccer and they're really a new team, and the really good girls are kind of hating on the girls that don't have as much experience. Now, if they could kindly say, hey, here's a tip, those girls would really appreciate it. But instead they're being kind of snooty. So there's a division in the team. You can see it on the field, that's something they'll work out as a team. But really, they just need to learn how to communicate and be a little more empathetic. That's something that they'll work on.
Isn't that the coach's job, though, Fadia? Isn't that the coach's job to get the new girls?
This is a new school system, to be fair. This is a new coach. And he's doing his best. He's got me coming in and working with them. But the thing about, not this particular coach, but with a coach, if they're going to do a good job, they have to be in integrity with themselves in their private life. Or if they're not, it's going to affect the team. That's something I've noticed. If you have a coach who's a little shady, I think that affects the team. But what do you think about that, Yogi?
Yeah, I think, of course. I mean, I think athletes, at the end of the day, when you look at an athlete whose career is over and they're in the workplace, they can smell BS quicker than anybody else because they've been fed it a lot. If you think about it, we've all had coaches that have told us we were great and didn't play us, or vice versa. So I think student athletes can smell inconsistency quicker than anyone else at the teenage level, to be really honest. I think they're street smarts. They learn on the field or the court. So, yeah, no, you're dead on.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'm going to let you go, and thank you so much for being on the show and answering my questions. Keep on rocking your awesomeness, Yogi. And thanks, Jeff. I'll talk to you guys later.
Thanks, Fadia. Good talking to you.
Thank you.
Fadia.
Yep.
Who occasioned as a guest host in the show. All right. I'm going to bring up one other coach. I read his book, John Wooden, the UCLA basketball coach from the 50s to the 80s, never talked about winning. He talked about your socks better be on right, your shoes better be tied right, all the way up to your shorts, to everything. He talked about being prepared.
Right. Yeah.
Which caused winning. He didn't talk about winning the game. He talked about being prepared to win the game. Just fascinating.
Right.
All right, so let's get off our sports talk here, and let's talk about let's go to what's going on in your life now. You have a film out.
Yeah, I'm really excited today. You know, 1st of April, we're really proud to announce that we're going to premiere Life in a Walk, our feature documentary film, at the Newport Film Festival on April 25th. So in less than a month, we're able to share it with a lot of people. And I can't wait. I mean, they already picked up a second date, so it'll be the 25th and the 28th in Southern California. And we're starting to build out other festivals that we'll start releasing, as well as other screening dates around the country. So for me, it's a really cool story to share, obviously. You know, this is a story about my father and I walking along the Camino de Santiago and me getting to know a man who I have always had a great relationship with, but on a level that I think we all want to know our parents on, and sometimes it becomes too late. And fundamentally, I told myself that I was never going to say the sentence, "I wish I spent more time with my dad." So I took him on this trip, and away we went. And when I came back, man, it was supposed to just be, who knows, a family film. And I started to talk to my friends and peers about it, and it influenced everyone. I was, wow, you know, I don't know where my dad was born, or I don't know how my parents met, or I don't know how my dad reacted when he got fired for the first time, or got a divorce, or had kids,
sure,
or went through adversity. And I said, wow, I think we have something. And started to cut it together. And we got about 70% through. And I thought, you know what, let's see if we can turn this into a conversation in the social media community. So we partnered with Indiegogo, a crowdfunding campaign, and we started our campaign. And the thing, from day one, we were on USA Today's page, and by the last final day of the campaign, day 40, we were featured in Men's Health. And we heard from people in multiple countries, both genders, across the globe, all ages, about how the simple idea about spending time with the people they care about resonated. And we turned it into a conversation. And it's my dream now and my goal now when we release this film is to, A, celebrate this amazing man in my life, but, B, create not only a conversation, but maybe a simple movement around spending time with people you care about and sharing in simple joys. And I think that's something real. And I think when you watch this film, you're going to feel that. Because what we do is we take place of the awkward conversation. So we all know, we all have parents out there, and when you have to talk to them, it can get awkward. Like, hey, Dad, you mind talking for a second? Well, you don't have to do that. You're going to be able to watch this film together, and you're going to have to talk. It takes place. It's going to make you feel uncomfortable. It's going to make you challenge yourself. You're going to lean back in your chair and evaluate who you are and what you stand for, but you're going to lean into your heart and your soul about, wow, do I know the people that matter to me? Because, look, dude, I wasn't that guy. I was the man who wouldn't call my parents back. I was the guy who was racing to try to create this entertainment career as fast as I could in my 20s, and I'm so lucky that I didn't miss out on it. I'm so lucky that I caught myself before it got too late, and we get to share this story, and I'm really proud of being vulnerable and sharing it because I think it'll have the opportunity to influence some people.
Doki, why don't you explain us about the history of this walk, how, where it is, geographically, what it's like, how long it took, how the walk started, where do you start in the beginning, where's the end of the walk, things of that nature.
Yeah, no, I would love to. So the Camino de Santiago, if you put it in on Google, there's not a ton that pops up. But what will pop up is that it is one of the most historic routes in existence in terms of when people way back centuries and centuries ago would walk along this pilgrimage from a variety of different starting points, some in France, some in Portugal, some in Spain. And they would walk to basically the northwest corner of Spain in a city called Santiago. And the goal would be to get to St. James Cathedral. And St. James Cathedral is this place that's held in high regard. And this walk was coined the Camino de Santiago, the way of St. James. And this was the path. And along this path, what became so amazing and endearing is that while everyone walks for their own reason, whether it be spiritual, whether it be religious, whether it be athletic, they get help along the way. And you're never truly alone. And when I say that, I mean, imagine walking from your town to the closest one next to you. Well, every door along the way would be open if you needed something to eat, a nap, a drink of water, go to the bathroom, a conversation. And that's what it's like along the Camino. So now add in the most picturesque rolling hills and fields and forests, and you have, to me, what is the greatest adventure that I've ever been on. And I think I've been to a decent amount of places, you know, over the last decade or so. But to go on this walk where there's not one, man, there's not one street sign. All there are these little yellow arrows that point you in the direction to go. So you want to talk about being mindful. You don't get to think ahead. You don't get to think, oh, it said Santa Monica 20 miles or it said Brooklyn 3 miles. That doesn't exist.
No Google Maps, you say. You don't look at your cell phone. You look at the signs. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah, there's no cell phone service. None of that. And it's great because you're totally lost. And we had times where we're like, man, we're going the right way. And then all of a sudden on a tree, a yellow arrow pops up. Or on a sign, on the ground, a yellow arrow pops up. And it's like the Camino talks to you. And to me, I'm so committed to this pilgrimage. I met with a woman this morning whose father's going on it alone. And I met so many people who have done that. And so many people walk alone on this pilgrimage and find that you never truly are alone. And it's really unique. It's extremely exciting. And I think this film captures it because there's not a lot of content around the community.
I mean, you walk through trails, roads, wilderness, small towns.
Oh, every single thing you can dream of.
Wow.
Every single thing you can dream of. And it's fascinating. It really is a special, special place. And one that I'm committed to taking my future kids there. And my dad and I, we hope to get back there this summer to celebrate and share this film. So it's been a really fun journey. And I have to say, like, our team, when we put it together, it was anyone and everyone who, A, had a connection, good, bad, or indifferent, with their parents or their children, as well as people who all were hoping to get a break in Hollywood to do a feature film. And I'm the same way. And we did. And I think when you see it, I think the community, and I'm excited to see what the community of, you know, film goers and critics think about it, but I think no matter what, even if you don't necessarily like every frame, it's going to prompt you, and this film will serve as a nudge for you to go talk to the people you care about and ask them the important questions before, God forbid, it becomes too late.
And do you bring a camera crew with you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was really unique. I got to partner with a company out of New York City called Plenty Productions, and I was working on a pilot with them, a travel show pilot, and it was all my own footage. And they were basically, in a very nice way, said, we'd like to shoot stuff with you that isn't on your iPhone. I said, okay, cool, I get it, guys. Well, I'm going to go on this next adventure. And they said, can we come? And I said, sure, here's the idea. So I brought two young cinematographers over, and they had never been really on adventures like this before. And away we went. And us four just walked and walked and walked and told stories and laughed. And they did such a beautiful job of capturing the cinema, and that when I came back, I then got to assemble my team that I just got to mention. We hired a young editor who had never done a feature before, 25-year-old woman named Samantha Young. We brought in my executive producer, Jonathan James, a guy who's done reality television for over a decade at the highest of levels. Then we brought in our editor who polished it all, a guy named Ed Borman, who had been doing major Hollywood trailers, a variety of different videos, but hadn't done a feature. But everybody was connected to this idea of spending time with your parents. And as the director, to not only direct the frame is really cool, but to watch how this film affected the people who are involved with us. The guy who did the music had never scored anything, but he's an extremely talented musician.
Wow.
You know, let's give him a shot. And to me, that's been beauty. And we've even gotten some really unique music. You know, Kate Vogel, extremely well-known singer-songwriter, gave us a song that she's never released before, and it's been released today on our trailer. You know, Alexander Ebert, who won a Golden Globe for the movie Always Lost, Robert Redford, gave us a song. So what we found is that this community of people who truly are mindful, you know, truly are aware of the simple joys in life, start to share, man. And it moves me every time I talk about it. And I've seen this film a thousand times, but every time I see it, I think about
it. Did you help edit it as well?
No, I sat in there during the edits, but no, that's a skill set that I definitely don't have. I wish I did.
It's not easy either, I'm guessing, to see parts that you may have thought are good.
Right. And I think it was good to have other sets of eyes on it.
And
then to make some decisions that made
the film successful. A first-time author on, and he said his editor was so important. He had a section of his book he's been writing for 30 years, and the author made him take it out. And even though he fought with her, he ended up agreeing with her. It didn't fit. So good editor, just amazing.
Right.
Hey, we just got an email about this subject. This is Samantha. She's from Spokane, Idaho. Wow. Never got anyone from Idaho before on the show. So I'm really enjoying your conversation today. Her question, how did making Life in a Walk change you? So how did making the movie or change you, or doing the walk, how did it change you as a person? Samantha's question.
You know, Samantha, thanks for listening, and I love going up to Washington. But
Washington,
in ways
Idaho.
That,
right?
What's that?
I said Idaho. I meant Washington. You're right, sir.
Oh, got you. It changed me in magnificent ways, to be honest with you. You know, made me stop for a minute, you know, and ask my parents the questions that we want the answers to, but we're afraid to ask. You know,
yeah.
How did you meet your partner? What was it like to get fired? Well, we went through every day. We sat down and went through a different decade of my dad's life. And he asked me questions, too. And I think looking at parents, and, you know, this is a space obviously I've been into for the last 2 years as I've done this film, that that's really fascinating. Because as a parent, your job is to protect your child and raise your child, one might say.
Sure.
Nowhere does it say it's to tell your child your story. And to me, that's accurate. You know, my dad was a better athlete than me, and I never heard about it. I heard about it from the barber. And to me, that was fascinating
really?
Because he never
yeah.
wanted to put his expectations on me or his career on me. But I also wanted to learn about it. Well, the only way I got to learn about it is by asking him. And I think that this doc will hopefully open up children to recognize, wow, man, my parents are actually kind of cool. It's kind of like that phase when we get older and all of a sudden we want to wear our parents' clothes. Right? Like my sister
right,
would do that.
Right.
Like she want to wear my mom's, you know, 60s bell bottoms. Or I want to rock my dad's old suit jacket. You know, we don't appreciate it until we get older. And my dad, you know, he got sick. You know, he had prostate cancer. And you know, he's doing great now. But I didn't deal with it. I was like, yeah, he'll be fine. Because he's my dad. He'll be great. But what
right.
I didn't deal with was
indestructible.
That, yeah, we're not. I'm going to die. You're going to die. We don't win in life, right? Like, eventually we lose. And
right.
It's, to me, I'm trying to live a life without any limits. And that means asking every question and seeking every curiosity I have. And this changed me in terms of, A, finding out those fundamental answers, but also understanding really what matters. And I think in our 20s, if we're trained in the United States of America, it's go to college and then climb the ladder as fast as possible. Very rarely
right.
outside of a vacation do we stop and pause, where someone who is mindful would not put more or less weight on a specific moment in time. They would give it all its attention, and try to live a life like that, which is very difficult, but when we're aware of it, it can be really fruitful and really fun. And for me, I was that guy who was racing as fast as I could, and to have this opportunity to be with my father and ask him these questions, it was incredible. And it's not like this is the sob story of father and son have a terrible relationship. I mean, we have an incredible
sure,
relationship.
Sure.
But
it's just,
we never
we discovered that they're humans, what you're saying, and we have to kind of, they have feet of clay.
Yeah, and look, we don't go there with our folks, and our folks don't go
right.
there with us. Or if they do, we
right.
give them BS answers, right? How's your day? It was cool. It was fine. It was whatever.
Right.
Well,
how good.
How about
yeah.
follow
okay.
up? You know, how about, yeah, exactly. And there's phases of that, and I get that adolescence and being a teenager. But these are people, if you think about it, that have the biggest effect on us. You know, I
right.
was talking to an aforementioned author named Samantha Edis, who would be great for your show, and she speaks to moms all over the globe about parenting. And we realized that, like, for daughters, their first date, their first love, their first relationship with a man is their father. So dads,
sure.
we've got a big-time role in not only our sons but also our daughters. And to me, sometimes we forget those elements because – we're racing and whatever we're doing. So hopefully this film can create some of those discussions.
Plus, most fathers want to shoot their daughter's first love anyway. So.
exactly.
This is probably why. Too much, don't yeah. marry someone like me, for crying out loud. Well, we've
right.
got another email, and we're kind of back to sports talk here. We'll get back into movie in a second. This is from Katie from Columbus, Ohio. Said, I heard you say that you host a TV show on quarterbacks. Who do you think should be the next starting quarterback for Ohio State next season, Braxton Miller or Cardale Jones? Is this a good problem for a coach to have? Two really good quarterbacks. One is a little bit less proven, I guess, Cardale Jones.
Well, hey, I'd ask for what about JT Barrett? Yeah, he's a guy who started
yeah,
a bunch of games.
Yeah, exactly.
Too.
Good point.
You know, that's a great question. You know, and I know all those guys. You know, do this show called The Elite 11. And the Elite 11 is basically American Idol for high school quarterbacks. You can check it all out at elite11.com. And it's great. You know, I get to know these kids, and our staff does at 16 years old. And from Braxton growing up, and, you know, I've just watched him work out, to Cardell, I remember him coming in, to JT, who's one of the most focused individuals I've ever been around. The guy grew up in a military family. His discipline showed up, you know, and Ohio State thought they were in a lot of trouble. So, to me, it's a good problem to have. It's like I said earlier about competition. It's going to be on Coach Meyer and his staff now to decide, you know, because you can't play three guys. I think you can play two. And
really?
I think they all have a different skill set. You know, you look at Braxton, you know, one would argue that, you know, he could play running back, right? One could argue that maybe he's not going to be a quarterback at the next level. So you can put him in a variety of different sets. What Cardell Jones did was insane. I mean, historic, obviously, in college football. To me, for him to shine on those stages, to me, he's got the keys to the car. I mean, you have to let him be the guy just because of what he did. At least give him that first rep in spring practice. And for JT Barrett, here's a guy coming off of an injury, so he's got to get healthy before they can even give him an opportunity, and that won't come until fall training camp. So right now, if I'm on that coaching staff, I'm evaluating really everything outside of the game. You know, like, of course, their decision-making and how they play
off
and
the field,
how they play the
right,
offense.
Right,
but it's how do they operate being the guy, you know? It's one
right.
thing when you're in the fire, right? If you look at Cardell Jones, he was in the fire for 3 weeks. I mean, he was in it. Didn't really have a lot of time to not prepare. Well, now you get a full off season. You get a summer. You get to see, all right, does this guy have dude qualities? Does he have the qualities to be the guy on our squad? And to me, that's the evaluation process. It's who's mature enough to handle it. Braxton clearly is. JT, I think, is. Cardell, we don't know because he hasn't gone through it. So that's, to me, how I – and I'm not trying to dance around not picking a guy, but that's how I would handle the situation.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tricky. So you're saying in college it's possible to have two quarterbacks run a team.
Oh, yeah, especially in these offenses that are spread and they're going, they're up-tempo. And Urban, you know, Coach Meyer, he did
right.
it in Florida with Chris Leak and Tim Tebow. So, you know, you can do it. I think that he is such a powerful figure that he's going to make it work in terms of Coach Meyer, and he's going to make the guys believe. So, look, at the end of the day, the more guys you can play, the better. And I think you feel it out game by game. But this is a team that they were by far the most talented team in the country last year. And they're going to be talented again this year. So I'm stoked to see what they do. I had a chance to spend some time with Coach Meyer last summer. I'll be at Ohio State the last weekend in May. We might actually have a screening of our film there, and I'll be there for our quarterback camp. So if you're out there and you're in Columbus, come hang out. We'll be running around.
Oh, we just got another email, of course. This is another quarterback question. It's Dave from Cleveland, Ohio. Wants to know if you think Johnny Manziel, besides the obvious problem, does he have the potential to be an NFL starting quarterback?
I do. You know, Johnny's another guy who came through the Elite 11. And Johnny, to me, is a really interesting kid. You know, and to me, what he's going through right now, is being in rehab and going through that process, is going to be really, obviously, critical for, number one, his just overall health, but also for him in his development. You know, and I've been around guys like Todd Marinovich and some of these other really talented athletes who, you know, have had their issues with substance abuse or had their issues with the media or had their issues with being scrutinized. And Johnny's gone through that, you could argue, more than any athlete in history. You know, with this day and age of social media and access to a student athlete and his brand and what he brought to the game, I mean, talk about the most electrifying player in the history of college football. And I don't think that's a bold statement. And what he did on that field at Texas A&M was insanely crazy. I think now when you get to the National Football League, number one, no one cares about that. But number two, you got to be in an environment where they allow you to have a personality. So I'm excited to see when he comes back how much of his personality was attached to, you know, whatever his issues
sure.
were, for whatever the
but
reason
But don't these
is.
Running quarterbacks yeah. always get – injured in the NFL, and they have, like, RG3, they have a hard time.
Well, RG3, when you look back at the actual numbers, you know, his the amount of times he was hit outside the pocket is dramatically low. To me, when you look at guys like Russell Wilson, you look at where, you know, I'm in the grassroots of high school football, obviously
right.
as a college football analyst as well. There are no more Andrew Lucks that are just rolling through college campuses. You get a couple guys a year, maybe, that are like that.
Sure.
Everyone's a dual threat. So the position is going to shift. You know, when you see this crop of old NFL quarterbacks Drew Brees, Tom Brady, Ben Roethlisberger, those guys eventually retire, it's going to be the Johnny Manziels of the world. So, yeah, there's a place for him. And he's clearly
But Russell Wilson
seen,
is smart. Russell Wilson doesn't take hits. He runs out of bounds, I've noticed.
Yeah, well, you can argue Johnny doesn't take hits either, you know. And I think that's something that coaches are always trying to get their guys to do. You know, RG3 didn't take a ton of hits. He got lit up when he was in the pocket because he had poor protection. So
oh, interesting.
You know, I don't think it's about these guys running out of the pocket. I mean, you'll watch Marcus Mariota. He's going to have a great career, you know. And you'll see, I think, a shift. But to answer the question, yeah, I think Johnny has a chance to start in the NFL. You know, he's got a guy, Josh McCown, who's there with him now. He's going to serve as an incredible mentor for him. And the biggest thing is going to be, A, him getting healthy, and then, B, watching about that edge. You know, does he lose that edge because he associated with what he did off the field? And
sure,
we'll find
sure.
out, you know, and that's going to be interesting.
Right. Now, speaking of college football, you were a college football coach, right? Where were you college
yeah,
football coach?
I coached at the University of Southern California. I had none of those guys.
How did you become one there?
Yeah, so I played college football at the University of Pittsburgh. And at the time, one of my teammates was a guy named Brennan Carroll. And Brennan's not only one of my best friends and mentors when I was in college, but we obviously stayed friends, you know, since then. And his dad was Pete Carroll, is Pete Carroll, and he was head coach at USC. And when Brennan finished, he came out to L.A. and started coaching, and I used to come visit on spring break. And I got to know the staff. I got to know the Lane Kiffins of the world, the Mark Jacksons of the world, the Steve Sarkisians of the world, and obviously Pete. And we all just connected. I think I fit in well within that group. And when I finished playing, I did a year of playing over in Australia, kind of just exploring life like most college grads do. He called me up one night around midnight and said, hey, what do you think about coming to SC? And I said, sure. I said, I don't want to coach, and I just want to go to grad school. So I'll do whatever. And he's like, cool. Come do player personnel, and we'll make sure grad school's handled. So I came out, and within 2 weeks, I can remember, we sat on his couch over a burrito. He goes, hey, what do you think about coaching? And I said, yeah, let's do it. And I became the lowest grunt on the totem pole and spent 2 years sleeping in the office, grinding as much as possible. But getting a master's at the Annenberg Communication School, because I knew I had this inkling of getting back into TV and entertainment and storytelling, but getting a PhD in football. And I did 2 years there. I was going to go jump to another team. Pete kept me and stuck around and did 2 more years working with quarterbacks, specifically when Steve Sarkisian was named the offensive coordinator. So all in all, I did 4 years at SC, got my master's, you know, won 4 Pac-10 titles at the time, and really learned about psychology. I learned about football. Pete challenged me to develop my own philosophy and approach. And when I left there, you know, you had opportunities to go coach at other teams, whether it was in college or the National Football League, and keep your career going. Because at SC, we were so good. It was just a launching pad for coaches. I looked at all the coaches I was around that had been in the profession for a while. And I said, you know what? I had fallen in love with football. I had fallen in love with 6 a.m. to midnight. I had fallen in love with sleeping in the office. I fall in love with it. This is great. But I also realized that I wasn't seeing a lot else in the world because the profession demands
sure.
so much of your time.
So do college coaches work those crazy hours? The pro coaches work as well?
They work harder. They work ridiculously harder because there's recruiting. You know, I think
that's true, right.
In college football you have maybe like 6 to 10 weekends a year that you're actually off. You know, not having a junior day, not having a recruiting meeting, not having a game, not having an official visit, not having an unofficial visit. You know, you're constantly, you're fundraising. There's always something going on. So college coaches, they have it harder than guys in the NFL from a time standpoint.
Wow.
I just wanted
right.
to try out more in my life.
You wrote a book with Pete Carroll, though, right?
I did. So when I left coaching, Pete and I, every night, I'd be there late, he'd be there late, and we would talk about just different goals and dreams and really about how to develop an approach, how to be mindful within that approach, and how to influence change. And if you followed Pete, if you really followed Pete, you saw that, in my eyes, he's one of the most forward-thinking individuals in the last 50 years. You know, with what he did, not only with the element of competition within an organization and a team, and building that, but within the community. You know, what he did with A Better LA, which is a nonprofit organization in Los Angeles, hoping to, you know, curb all gang violence in LA. What he's done in Seattle with A Better Seattle and doing those same types of things, is fascinating. And I can remember this like yesterday. We had a whiteboard, and in the middle of it, we put the words "win forever." And that was a phraseology that Pete had kind of grown towards, and it was obviously the title of the book that we wrote. And I thought, what can we do around this concept? We could write a book, right? Let's go do that. What if we had a peace rally? You know, let's go do that. And we had a peace rally in L.A. Let's go see if we can do X, Y, and Z. And all of a sudden, we started putting all these things down. And it started to happen. And for me, that was really exciting to kind of just develop that, not only that relationship, but to be around a thought leader and then take some shots at some things and have some fun doing it and leveraging sports, because sports is the one thing that cuts between societal issues. You know, I could roll out a soccer ball and the worst community with black, brown, white people all around, and
sure,
we could be fine because we all can relate through that sport. Well, Pete, being right, the guy that he is, and he's so revered, he nailed that, and he started making real change. So to be around that at a young age, what I was really developing in my own approach was a gift that I'll always be ridiculously thankful for.
So is Pete a leader of young men then? Would you say he's a leader of developer,
I think he's
young
a leader
men?
Of young, old, you know, and everybody in between. You know, I've seen police chiefs sit and listen to every word that he said. I've seen him around politicians. I've seen him around athletes. I've seen him around parents. And the best quality of Pete is that he's the best listener I've ever been around. You know, what he's doing now, I mean, his organization is influencing major corporations, whether it's Boeing, whether it's Microsoft. You know, they're in there and coaching up the corporate leaders on the power of having a philosophy and having an approach. And to be it, you know, to have a seat at that table and to be right next to him, that was a gift. It was an absolute gift. So, it was something very special.
Great. Well, let's kind of switch to girls for a second. I saw you kind of have something going with JCPenney's Girls Empowerment Program. What's that about?
Yeah. No, it's been really cool. So I spent the off season, usually when it's not football season, I'm always trying to tell one story a year, whether it's through a book or a documentary. And I also kind of jump on the speaking circuit. And this past offseason has been a really fascinating one for me because I've just been able to be around some really unique minds. You know, Alexis Jones, if you don't know her, check her out. She wrote a book called I Am That Girl. And she's created this really unique nonprofit and a couple other things that she's got obviously going on. But you know, one of the most powerful women in the world. And she's all about empowering young women. And she brought me into this community, and vice versa, I brought her into the sports community, and we try to collaborate as many times as possible to help young people understand that we all have a story. And in an era where you're constantly, you know, you can be mocked, you can be bullied, you can be laughed at because you want to share some element of yourself, it's our mission to go out and make sure everybody understands that, no, we all have a story to share, and it's not only important to share it, but it's almost a must. And she partnered with JCPenney and Girls Inc. to really provide a really cool day for about 15 girls from inner city Los Angeles. And we all did workshops. And they brought me in up in this sweet Hollywood hotel. And we had one of the most fun afternoons talking about storytelling and what the power of it is and how you find your voice and how you develop it. So, and I've been lucky to do a bunch of those over the last 2 months all across the country. And it's something I'm committed to because when I was a kid, I was the guy who always journaled, and I journaled because I didn't have a strong enough voice to be able to share verbally, vocally, my beliefs, you know, and I don't want that to happen. You know, I think it's important to write, but I also think it's important to speak. I think it's important to share.
Great. We just got another email back to kind of exploring. This is from Daphne, Boulder, Colorado. Her question is, you've described yourself as an explorer. And she says, besides the Camino del Santiago, what are a few of your other favorite places to explore? Daphne.
Yeah. Well, great question. Yeah, well, I've been really committed to the idea of twice a year I try to go anywhere for 2 to 4 weeks per trip. You know, go after the season, go before the season, and just go get wonderfully lost, you know, so I like to describe it. You know, in work, I like to be extremely diligent and have a plan, but when I travel, I purposely don't. I go, every trip is based on feel. So the last couple of trips I've been on have been really fun. You know, I spent last summer in Brazil exploring around the World Cup. I spent last winter, I sailed around Cape Horn. Cape Horn is the very tip of South America. And
right.
I wanted to go when I was 8 years old. And it'll be the next documentary that we're working on. And we just started working on it. I'm really excited about it. But we went down with five people who had never met. to the most dangerous sea in the world, and we all talked about our issues of commitment. And it was a really fun experience, and it's going to be a beautiful film. So that was a great one. You know, I've done a month in India. I spent summers in Europe. I've really spent my 20s throughout all of South America, whether it was, you know, I absolutely fell in love with every element of those trips. So, yeah, I mean, I've been through Cambodia, Vietnam, Laos. I mean, I try to drop in a variety of different places. You know, I think I've been over 20-some countries now. But it's what drives me. You know, it's not about standing up on my soapbox and saying I get to go explore. It's literally what feeds my soul. You know, it's why I left coaching, because there wasn't enough time. There wasn't enough time to go take those trips. So that's what I've committed my life to do. And I'm excited this summer to take our film over to Spain.
Great. Hey, let's go just a little bit kind of on your website again. It states you're an aspiring map maker. What's that all about?
Well, to me, when you look at people who've really, enacted some sort of shift in the world, right? They've done it because they've taken a different path. And to me, the term that I love, and you know, I talked about it with a guy I mentioned earlier, a guy named Dr. Michael Gervais. You know, he opened my eyes to that term. You know, yeah, map maker. That would be cool to create your own path. You know, Magellan did it, right? Everybody used to sail around Cape Horn in South America until he found the Strait of Magellan and said, whoa.
Right.
There's this other way we can do this. And to me, you know, I don't know if it's a bad thing or not, but every time, whether I'm on a hike or a run, I'm always trying to just take some different path. And I think, clearly, we talked about it, my path as an athlete was different. You know, no one told me to go walk on other than me. You know, my path as a coach was different. No one in their right mind in the coaching profession would leave coaching after being catapulted out of USC. So it's not a humble brag. It's just who I am. You know, that's my voice. So to me, that's an aspiring map maker is. It's somebody who's always seeking, you know, is there a different way? Isn't it maybe a more curious route? Or what's it like behind that tree? That's just who I am, you know. So I haven't gotten there yet, right? I haven't created that map yet, but I'm working on it. And to me, it's not real unless you write it down. So I said, you know what, let's put it on there and see what happens.
Just a quick question before we go. Should college athletes be paid because there's billions of dollars being made off their work?
It's a hot topic, right? And I think there's great arguments on both sides. Where I stand in it as a former athlete and someone who covers athletics and gets paid because of these events now, I don't think college athletes should get paid. I think their stipend should increase. And one might argue, well, that's just a way to pay them. And maybe that's the case. But the minute that you start comparing schools and saying, okay, at Alabama, whose revenue is X,
right,
and at Duquesne University, whose revenue is Y, we're going to give them a percentage of revenue. Well, now it's going to really alter the competitive landscape. And you could even just take two schools in the same conference. You know, you can take a private school in the Pac-12 and a public school, and their revenues are going to be different in the way they're shared.
Right.
All of a sudden, if you're giving X percent to X athlete, now it becomes a competitive advantage in recruiting. I believe that based on the living situation and whatever the cost of living is in that region, in that geography, their stipend should
And what about teaching how to be a professional athlete? Can we teach them how to be a professional athlete? And what's wrong with that? You know, be it in Europe, be it in the United States.
Well, I don't know. I think
you're to go to school, you know.
Right, but I think when I look at college, and I can remember talking to Larry Fitzgerald. He's my college roommate. We talked about this when he came out of college early. You go to college to do what? To go further your expertise. Some people go to college to be a doctor. Some people go to college to be a scientist. Some go to be a host. Some go to be an athlete. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. So when you get your opportunity to leave, whether that's after 18 years old or 19 or 2 years in college or 4 years in college, your job is to prepare yourself for the real world. And your real world as an athlete is within an athletic culture. So I firmly believe that when you're ready to leave, if you feel you're ready to leave, you can go play. But when you're in college, you're a college athlete. And yes, do colleges train young student athletes how to be professionals? You bet they do. There's a multiple amounts of courses that are on college campuses that are mandatory for student athletes all across the country. So that's happening, man. But I don't think we treat them as professionals because they're not, you know. And if you want to be, go be one. And you can go find there's loopholes in every sport where you can go make that happen. But I think the setting we're now in, we need to pay them more within their stipend, but not treat them as quote-unquote professional athletes, because
right.
they're not.
And what about when, for instance, these video games, there's still money being made off them, and the video games, you know, that's when somebody was a college athlete, I think a basketball player sued recently.
Yeah, look, I was in those video games. You know, like, I'm in those video games as an athlete. It was the coolest thing ever. You know, so anybody who doesn't think that's sweet is lying when you get to play yourself
right.
as a college athlete. But they don't do that anymore, right? EA Sports does not even create those games anymore. So, it was a rightful argument. It was Ed O'Bannon's case, and I totally agree with, you know, the stance he was on. And the NCAA for years has taken advantage of these student-athletes, but we have to understand that these student-athletes wouldn't have a platform if it wasn't for the NCAA. Players in the NFL complaining about, you know, well, we have to wear these specific things after these media appearances. Well, the NFL is also giving you a platform and created
sure.
your platform. So I think it's two ways. And it's too rigid right now towards the NCAA, but they're going to shift. They're going to shift. It's totally going to happen. And there's going to be some
right.
sort of middle ground. But I don't think we'll see a 180 and all of a sudden it's going to be all about taking
sure.
care of the athletes, making them feel right. That, there's no chance that's going to happen. But there are elements.
Now, how come the NFL never loses
profile.
A court case, though? How come they can never lose a court case when people challenge
well,
them, young people challenge them?
Like what? Like
oh, like Maurice Claret wanted to play in the league a year early. You had to play X amount of years in college to be in the NFL or
right.
be a certain age, right?
Yeah, well, you don't have to play X amount of years in college, but you just have to be in college for X amount of years or be out of high school for X amount of years. So,
right.
you know, you can
right.
go, you want to go play in Europe, you can go do it. Now, I agree with that to a degree. But the problem is that in football, we're finding it's one of the most violent sports that
sure.
exist. And I'm around high school athletes all the time. And there may be an 18-year-old who's on his way to a major university that has the size and the speed that he can go live on a practice in the National Football League for 3 weeks. But I don't think they're mature enough at all
right.
to handle the physical and mental side of it. Now, are there exceptions? Of course. Running back is a great position. You only get X amount of carries. You're seeing most running backs leave early in college because they realize that their body only takes X amount of hits. And I agree with
right.
that. And I understand Maurice Claret's case, but I think if all of a sudden you start making one-off exceptions to the rule, I think you're going to be in trouble. I mean, we're seeing in basketball, right? We're seeing one-and-dones ruin
right,
basketball
right.
games. I hope they go back and allow, if you want to come out early in basketball, you can come out to do that. I just think football is such a more violent game.
Got
I
it.
Would hate to see that happen. I would hate to see a receiver who's 170 pounds but can run like the wind, whose family needs the support, to come out early and get absolutely broken in half when he comes across the middle of the National
Yeah, the wind
kind of
slows down when you get to the NFL, right?
Yeah, it's a little bit different, yeah.
All right. So speaking of the NFL, I know we've gone over a little bit. We'll end up in a second. Roger Goodell has been very inconsistent this year as far as dishing out certain punishments with Ray Rice.
Yeah. Well, I think he learned his lesson, you know, to be honest. You know, he started that way, and then I think clearly they adjusted, you know. So, and I think they were right to adjust. It was embarrassing when it kind of came out, and it was, oh, I forget, 2 or 3 game of suspension or whatever it was. And he recognized it, you know, and it's neat, you know. We always jump on people of what they did wrong, but we also have to remember
sure.
that, like, for the NFL, this is the first time they ever dealt with this, really. It's been going on for a long time. This is the first time they
oh,
really
forever.
Dealt
yeah.
with it. Yeah, so they weren't going to get it right. You never do, right? Your first, you know, radio show, you didn't get right. You know, my
right,
first interview,
yeah.
I didn't get right. So, look, it's on a completely different scale, and I'm not giving him a pass, but to expect the NFL to have gotten it right from jump is crazy. Because there's so many layers. There's the players union, there's all these things. But where they ended with zero tolerance, yeah, that's what I can applaud and get behind.
Right. What about you think they're going to relax their law, their rules on people smoking marijuana? If let's say it's illegal in Colorado and you play for the Denver Broncos, would they relax that rule, or are they going to stand, you know, tough on that rule?
I don't know that. That's a good one, because there's medical elements, right? There's a variety of different
sure.
arguments. I would bet that it would live within the league, and the league would supersede state law. I mean, that's how it is in college
right.
football now. You know, it's legal to smoke marijuana in certain states, but within their athletic departments, it's considered a violation. So I couldn't see a ton of pushback happening there, at least just yet, you know.
Right. And let's kind of finish. We'll go back to your movie in a second, your premiere. Concussions. What can be done to help prevent concussions so, you know, football doesn't become a dinosaur?
Yeah, well, I don't think football is going to ever become a dinosaur. I think it's too big. I think that it gives too many answers to young student athletes from an educational standpoint and then eventually a professional opportunity. But I do think it's a real issue. You know, I think that the stance the NFL is taking is huge. And I go on these shows a lot with old NFL players that sometimes disagree and say, you know, we're ruining the game. We're taking away the integrity, the beauty of the game. And we just have to look to history, man. And you didn't always have to wear a seatbelt. You know, you didn't have your child in a car
seat. Right, exactly.
You used to be able to smoke on an airplane. You know, things change. And those are clearly ridiculous examples, but things are going to shift, and they have shifted. And we won't recognize football has changed for another 5 or 10 years because it's got to go get – it starts at the top, right, your role models, and then eventually trickles its way down to the youth. And when the fifth-grade linebacker gets into college and then the NFL in 7 years, 8, 9, 10 years, that's when we're going to see the shift. Because, look, I was trained to put my head in the guy's sternum, you know, right in the middle of his back. That's the worst thing you can be taught. And there's coaches out there still teaching that to a degree. But I think you're seeing guys like Pete Carroll and the Seahawks teaching the rugby-style tackling. You're seeing coaches teaching literally for a period or two every day of practice. You know, I go to football practices all the time where they're teaching them to get their head out of the way. So I do think it's a major point of emphasis. I think we'll eventually see the shift. I think we've seen a slight decline in numbers in youth football, and we should. I don't think you need to be playing tackle that young, but overall, the game, we're talking about the most popular sport in the United States, and it's only growing.
Right, right. Have you ever heard of Joe Turkey Jones, Cleveland Browns, 70s?
No, I don't know where that is.
The Browns and the Steelers used to have wars, and even though in the 70s the Steelers were better, every game was a war. Joe picked up Terry Bradshaw, and he corkscrewed him headfirst into the ground. Did you Google it?
Oh, I did. I read an article about it the other day, actually. Yeah,
and if that were to happen today, Joe would have been out of football for the rest of his life. Back then, Joe visits Terry in the hospital. How you doing? Hope you're feeling better. And Terry goes, yeah, I'm okay. You know, that's it.
Right.
Well, great. I want to finish up. We went a little bit over, so let's talk about your premiere tonight. You're going to have a movie premiere in Newport Beach, is it?
Yeah, not tonight. Our movie premiere, you can check everything out at lifeinawalk.com. Lifeinawalk.com. And we're going to premiere our film on April 25th.
Okay.
It's going to be awesome. 7:30 at night.
Gotcha.
It's going to be great. And then we'll premiere it again. We'll come out again on the 28th. And there'll be a bunch of other screenings. So you can totally dive in and follow everything at lifeinawalk.com, all of our social channels. I'll be keeping everybody updated. And if you're around, come check it out. We'll try to bring it to anyone who wants it. And I think it's going to hopefully move some people and move the needle a little bit.
Great. It's been a great, fascinating conversation. Yogi Roth, thank you so much. Again, if you want to guest host on the show, we'd love you to do it and really appreciate you being on the show. Namaste to you, Yogi.
Namaste.
Take care. Bye.